This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, there are a number of things that are starting to matter in the market. Rising oil prices, rising inflation, rising in interest rates. These things didn't seem to matter in 2016 and 2017. They now are impacting the market. Joining me on the program is Greg Weldon from Weldon Live. Greg, we were going to do a small segment, but you've put together a incredible report that we'll talk about that you're going to make available to Financial Sense listeners. There's just so much information in here that I wanted to do a special segment on it because we're going to cover a lot of ground today. We're going to cover some things that people aren't talking about that are taking place that are going to impact the markets. I don't care if you're looking at markets here, markets overseas, what's going on with interest rates, the deficit, the whole shebang. So Greg, let's begin with the first part of this report. And that's your thesis on global stagflation, where we're seeing anemic economic growth and higher rates of inflation. Let's begin with Europe, Germany, and Canada.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You know, you have this whole thought process over the last few months. You know, U.S. has been a big growth engine and that this has spread throughout the world. And you've kind of seen that. I mean, in the case of Germany, it's been an export juggernaut, above 100 billion euro in exports for the last 19, 20, 21 months or so in a row, big surpluses. The offshoot of that, the first derivative of the export juggernaut in Germany is the countries that provide Germany with semi-finished goods that Germany finishes and ships to the U.S. And those are countries like the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Poland. When you look at those countries, you would kind of expect to see any kind of slowdown would materialize there first. And indeed, we have seen retail sales in these countries have plummeted. And when you kind of tie in what you see with erosion in Germany itself, it's pretty interesting. And the speed with which you're seeing the growth slow, and it's not yet contraction in retail sales, but it's awfully close. At the same time, you've seen inflation being stoked here. And really, this goes back to last year. If you ask me, inflation bottomed in 2016. It got up to a high in February of 2017. It backed off. In places like Europe, it backed off because the euro was so strong last year. Germany was the beneficiary of that in that it really squelched what might have been a pop in inflation to well above the ECB's target of 2%. Well, at this point, you have inflation, and the high inflation countries are kind of even the second or third derivative. And believe it or not, to me, everything matters. And when you look at a place like Estonia, okay, or for example, Slovakia, I mean, you're seeing some real declines in retail sales and a jump in inflation to the point where real retail sales is now contracting. All right. So you see the stagflation in Europe, and that's an interesting place to see it first. In terms of Canada, you see it because they're linked to trade. I mean, the trade is not the catalyst for this, but it is definitely exacerbating all of what we have going on. You already had these kind of price pressures developing in terms of things you haven't seen since 1990, supply chain disruptions. And now you got tariffs and you got shortages and you got steel prices higher. I mean, kind of it's exacerbated and intensified everything. And when you take a country like Canada, I mean, they really get hit in terms of, you know, a trade war is just like a cold war, just like a nuclear war. It's mutually assured destruction. So it's called MAD. It was the whole thing between Russia and the U.S. back in the 50s and 60s. It's the same thing in trade. A trade war hurts everybody. The position here is that U.S. is the free trader. These other countries aren't. Something had to be done. And in this case, the approach taken by the administration here in the U.S. is, well, if everybody's going to hurt, they're going to hurt more and more quickly to where they're going to be the ones crying uncle. And it's a dangerous strategy. It's like we've had this conversation before, in fact, on this exact topic, where it is basically you're standing there dousing gasoline, holding a lit match, trying not to catch on fire, you know. But having said that, it exacerbates the inflation. And the flip side of that in trade in places like Canada and Germany is to exacerbate the slowdown in the economy. And it's a double-edged sword, and it's already slicing, and now you have a trade issue, which really intensifies the whole thing.
Well, let's talk about the issue that's going on with the United States, and it's almost like a tit for tat. We slap tariffs on China, China's slapping tariffs on us. Trump gave a speech last night talking about when they ship stuff here, we add on 2.5. When we ship stuff there, they add on 25%. So is this just escalate, Greg, in your opinion? You do this, okay, we're going to do this. How does this get resolved other than what we're seeing right now, which is higher inflation, which slows down economic growth?
It stops when someone blinks. And, you know, the strategy here is that the U.S. is in a stronger position, number one, economically. And that's true to some extent. I mean, let's be fair. Everyone's at risk here, you know. And when you talk about the U.S., before I basically make the case for the U.S., it's the consumer. It's the local businessman. It's the guy who's paying more for steel. They can't afford to pass along the price increase where margins are getting crushed for small businesses. It's the consumer who's lived, you know, 5 years now high on the hog on cheap and ever cheaper deflating prices for imported consumer goods from China. Apparel, electronics, computers, furniture. These are the big imports that we take in. That's going to change. I mean, you're going to have higher prices for these things. So there's definitely damage done to the U.S. There's no doubt about it. But the strategy here is, as I said before, that you end this because somebody blinks. And who blinks? The person blinks who's going to hurt the most, is hurting the most, is losing the most, or has the most to lose. And in pretty much every single case, it's the other guy. If you're not in the U.S., it's China, it's Canada, it's Germany. And, you know, it's interesting to me because it becomes political, Jim. And this is part of the problem. I understand. But I mean, at some point, you want to unite as a country. The end of the day is when I hear people that don't know the facts out there saying, oh, go Angela Merkel, you kicked Trump's behind, you know, so on and so forth, without knowing the facts, it's emotion driving people's kind of loyalties almost to where you'd rather side with a socialist leader who is not a free trader than with your own country at the expense of the small U.S. businessman, the U.S. auto manufacturers, the parts makers. I mean, it becomes such a political hot potato. I mean, it almost takes a guy like Donald Trump who just doesn't care what people think of him to kind of get the job done. But it's a dangerous game. I mean, it could backfire. You know, the risk is always that China gets upset enough to go ahead with a mutually assured destruction scenario and starts to sell U.S. bonds. So there's risk all over the place.
So when you take the U.S., which has the world's largest economy, China the second, and also when you consider that we're the buyer of last resort, given our huge trade deficits that we're running, doesn't that put us in a little bit stronger negotiating power? If, you know, a lot of your exports are going to the U.S., doesn't that give the president a little heft when it comes to negotiation?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm absolutely positive that's the reason they're taking this approach. I mean, you have the math on your side if you put aside kind of the financial markets and the bond market, because that's where the math kind of runs out as a protecting mechanism. But absolutely. I mean, I've done studies, and in fact, you know, we're talking about just some of the work I've done recently, is you break down the numbers of what exactly is traded between countries. What are the imports? What are the exports? What are the products? What does it mean to total GDP? And there is no doubt, even with China, that the U.S. is in a commanding position to withstand the theoretical pain, economically speaking, okay, by far. And that's the gamble. That's the gamble that Donald Trump is making here, is that, you know, the other guy's going to blink because the other guy's going to have to blink. And that there's a credible thought process behind that.
I want to take this and now move over to the U.S. side. We're seeing stagflation in Europe. We're seeing it in Canada. Let's talk about the deep dive that you did on the inflation numbers. In the recent upgrade by the Fed, they upgraded their inflation numbers. Let's talk about the last FOMC meeting. They did a number of things that really struck me. Number one, they raised the dot plot from 3 hikes to 4. They removed 80 words of accommodation in the minutes that accompanied the meeting. They got rid of forward guidance, and then something they haven't done before. It started with Bernanke, but starting in January of next year, they're going to have press conferences after every single meeting. They may need it to calm the markets. So let's talk about where inflation is heading here.
Well, I mean, the $64 million question and the $128 million question is, you know, will the Fed chase inflation? Because I think inflation is going higher, and I don't think there's any doubt about that. We could talk about the statistics. We could talk about the big special report I just wrote where we dig deep into all of this, all right? Every single statistic, every single angle on every single statistic. And you know me, we dig to the most micro level to see things before kind of there's, you know, a general recognition of things because people just don't dig as deep as we do. When I look at the inflation picture, I see one thing that is so dramatically different that it is glaring than anything we've seen in the past 25 years. And of course, trade plays into this, but again, trade is not causing it. Trade is exacerbating it. And that is simply this, you know, inventory, hand to mouth, all the automation around. And, you know, at the point of final sales, inventories are really low, dramatically low, and have continued to kind of fall. And as you see the issues with trade and just the issues with some of the tightness, the supply chain is experiencing disruptions to where backlogs of orders are lengthening and delivery times are lengthening. And now you've gotten into, and you, the Fed data shows this, the Fed surveys show this. This is something that is very evident if you look at the evidence. And it is that vendors are now bidding up for finished goods to try and make sure they can meet demand of their customers. So we haven't seen this kind of embedded pipeline backloaded inflation. PPI numbers were amazing, okay? Let alone what's going on with import prices, which is always, when Yellen used to talk about the transitory factors in inflation, why is inflation not rising? Well, it's transitory factors. Well, Janet, what are those transitory factors? Well, we really don't know, but we're kind of counting on that it's transit, you know, so on and so forth. I mean, it's always import prices. They've been down for the better part of 5 years. Now they're going up. And because of the dollar's decline last year, in part because of trade, in part, and because of, you know, just natural factors in part. So this is almost a perfect storm of inflation dynamics. And if the Fed backs off here, and there are already indications that if the stock market cracks, the Fed might be willing to back off, you know, that could stoke an inflation that we haven't seen in a long time. The kind of back pipeline loaded inflation I'm talking about in terms of supply chains and that level of where people are willing to pay higher prices. 1990 was the last time we saw that. I've been in the business almost, I actually started my 35th year this month doing this. And 1990 is the last time we saw this setup for inflation. It's big. So it comes down to what does the Fed do? Does the Fed chase inflation? Because frankly, the Fed tells us they're going to be at 2.5 by the end of the year. I mean, it could be 3 is your neutral rate. They want to be neutral, not even tight. They want to be neutral. And if they have to chase inflation higher, will they do it at the risk of bringing the hammer down on the consumer who's more overleveraged than since 2007 and is overleveraged to the stock market? So stock market goes down because the Fed's getting tight because inflation's rising. That's going to put them in a box and create a huge problem. This is where it all gets so interesting because, man, there's going to be a lot of turbulence in the next 6 to 12 to 18 months. I mean, no matter how this plays out, it doesn't play out in a calm way.
I want to talk about something that is significant, and I wonder if you might explain it to our listeners. And that is the change year over year in index points in inflation. You talk about this, a big jump. And more importantly, you talk about the last time we saw something like this was in 1979, 1990, as you just mentioned, 2005, 2007, and 2011. Those were not good years for the market.
Yeah, and that's kind of the secret indicator that we've talked about a lot. You know, the CPI, okay, and we also do it with the core CPI, actually. This is what we're talking about, right? The index, not import prices, but actual CPI. If you look at the changes in the points, not the percent changes in the points, and understanding that as CPI goes up, because pretty much CPI, the index, hits a new high every month. I mean, let's not forget that the consumer price index hits a record high every single month, all right? And remind me to talk about food price inflation because it's really important to all of this. But when the index gets to a 6-point year-over-year gain, you tend to run into turbulence. And if you mark the dates that this has happened every single time, I mean, you go back, you know, 2005, maybe the one opt-out, you know, and I understand as the nominal number gets higher, getting a 6-point change becomes a little easier. So, you know, we're always aware to try and maintain some robustness to the numbers, but it still works in my mind. And particularly when you see cores right there too, not often you see core, which is just shy of 6 points, and headline CPI, 6 points in the same 12-month period. That almost always spells turbulence and ultimately causes some kind of downturn in final demand and kind of fits in with what we see in the yield curve, for example.
I want to talk about food price inflation, and let's also talk about energy, because when you see the pundits on television or even the Fed itself, they'll talk about inflation excluding food and energy. Well, you know, it's like we don't use gasoline and we don't eat food. So let's talk about both of them.
Well, first off, when you say it that way, the very first point to make is, okay, core PCE is 1.8. It's almost at the Fed's target. All right. That's excluding food and energy. Okay. Core CPI is 2.2. It's above 2. And according to the Fed's Chicago studies, you know, consistency with 2% PCE, which is their goal, is 2.25 core CPI and 2.5 headline CPI. All right. Headline CPI is 2.8. It's almost 3. Okay. CPI in Los Angeles is 4.1. There are many cities around the country. I mean, you look at where people live, actually live, CPI is 3% or higher. So that's a whole nother ball of wax. Then when you talk about food and energy, all right, when you have food and energy prices rising at the same time, it's inevitable. You have a problem. It's inevitable. They're going to see a slowdown in retail sales of discretionary goods. It's just that simple. Now, I'll make a case here, too, in our special report. It's another kind of one of the hidden gems in this report, is to note that if you take food price inflation, it's pretty low. It went to a high of 1.6 or 1.7, I think it was just recently. It's vacillated from between 1.2 and 1.6. It was negative a year ago. So it's popped from negative to positive. All right. But it's still what's considered low. You know, so you look at it from that perspective. But if you take the retail sales number, the amount of money spent every month on food and in grocery stores, okay, is rising way more than would be made up for with the change in prices. And way more that would be any reasonable increase in the amount of demand for actual food, all right? Less people are eating 1.5 times as much food every day, all right? That's not happening. But what's happening? I mean, you're kind of mystified by the degree of change in retail sales at grocery stores versus the lack of inflation in food. I'll give you exactly what it is. It's hidden inflation. It is buying a 12-ounce bag of coffee for $6, $8, let's call it $8, a 12-ounce bag of coffee for $8. Well, now all of a sudden, it's not a 12-ounce bag anymore. It's an 8-ounce bag, and it still costs $8, all right? So you're spending more at the grocery store to buy the same amount of stuff, but it doesn't show up kind of in the food price inflation numbers. It's one of those quirks. So I would suggest food price inflation is understated. And the other side of that coin, too, is to think that food price inflation risk isn't real, okay? And if to think this is because of what's happened in the grain markets this year and off of trade and everything, I'll tell you what, I'm hearing this on TV now, but 2 weeks ago, I was one of the first people to talk about, look, it doesn't matter to soybeans if they're going to have some kind of trade issue around soybeans. Why? Because Argentina is the main exporter of soybean meal, which is the real product here, to China. All right. They just had a drought where they lost almost a third of their crop. They can't even fulfill the orders they have out of their own pool of soybean meal. They're buying U.S. soybean meal hand over fist to meet export orders. China will get their soybean meal from somewhere, and whoever they get it from likely gets it from the U.S. It doesn't matter because the supply-demand fundamentals in some of these food markets are so razor thin that if you don't get the ideal crop this year and you're kind of on your way to getting it, ideal conditions, ideal planting ahead of schedule, emergencies ahead of schedule, so on and so on, but you need it because demand is also at a record every single year. And last year was the first year in many you didn't grow by more in output as you did demand. So razor thin margins in these food things still set up to where prices might be low now. But I'll tell you what, if they go much higher, they could go a lot higher. And then you're comparing them to these levels a year from now. I mean, this could be a big deal, you know, over the next, let's say, 3 months from now, you know, for the next 9 months after that.
Let's talk about how all of this is coming together here. We've seen CPI year over year, it's up 2.8%. The Fed's PCE is at target levels. We're seeing, Greg, in the ISM reports, in regional Fed surveys, and the prices paid components, they're rising. We also have pipeline inflation baked in. Supply side disruptions, you're having companies with the labor pool down having to pay up. Wage inflation is rising at the same time. Now you throw in, as you were talking earlier, we have tariffs that are going into effect, which is going to impact, obviously, the things we import in this country. When you add this all up, and maybe this is one reason why we saw in last week's FOMC meeting, the Fed's getting more aggressive. But how aggressive can they be? Because I want to move into something else that you talk about in this report. Let's talk about the budget deficit in the United States. And to put this in perspective, with no political opinions, Bush doubled the deficit from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. Obama doubled the deficit from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. Under Trump, we're on our way to trillion-dollar deficits again, and we're not even in a recession yet. The difference, though, Greg, this time around, what you touch upon in your report, in the 8 years under Obama, the Fed was embarked on QE, and they were driving down long-term interest rates to the point in 2016, we got to the lowest point in interest rates in 5,000 years of history. We are now moving in the opposite direction, and let's talk about the budget deficit and how much money the government is now starting to shell out in interest expense.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem. It's something I've been talking about really since you started to see the last of the numbers from last fiscal year, which ended end of September. So, you know, we've been on board this train for the better part of 10, 11 months and anticipating this because it was pretty easy to see. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. Interest rates go up. You have a monthly refunding. You're paying more. Now, it's not that simple because debt matures, you know, with various coupon rates. So this is not as immediate as a problem as it might at first appear, okay? But that's not to minimize the problem by any stretch of the imagination because the problem's already huge. Like you say, you're at around $240 billion for the first 8 months of the year in interest expense. You are now more than half of the defense budget. I mean, that's disturbing. All right. You're up by tens and tens of billions. I think it's somewhere along the line of almost 20% is the year over year change. This will accelerate by mathematical necessity. Unless interest rates go to new lows, and we can talk about that in a minute, you know, this is going to be an ongoing problem that will get worse as the bonds that mature start to have lower and lower coupons that are expiring. So in this sense, you're going to go flip-flop here in the not too distant future. And in some cases you have already, with what is expiring and maturing, that you will be paying more now. So that just adds on to this. So this is going to go parabolic, all right, number one. Number two, when you're talking about the numbers for May, all right, you spent $350 billion and took in about $200 billion. I mean, okay, we know there's a big spending package. Was it necessary? Maybe this is necessary. I'm not arguing the necessity. I'm not arguing it from a moral or academic standpoint at all. I'm looking at it from the math perspective and how it impacts the market. Just that simple. And in this case, within that spending and for the first 8 months of the fiscal year, entitlements are $1 trillion already. All right. That's just insane. So this is not sustainable. You're going to be pushing over $1 trillion easily. You could track depending on how, where interest rates go. You know, there are scenarios we could track back out to 1.3, you know, more likely is around 1.1, 1.095, 1.15, something like that. But at any rate, it adds on to the public debt. The worst part of this number, though, had nothing to do with the spending and the actual deficit and so on and so forth. It had to do with the means of financing it. In the first 8 months of the year, it's over $750 billion of new borrowed money. So, you know, again, that's where you start to extrapolate numbers for the debt, okay, where, I mean, the CBO just upped their estimates for 2028 to, I think, something like $34 billion. From like 31, you know, the numbers are off the charts. And at some point, this becomes a problem. When does it become a problem? Well, to me, it becomes a problem when the 30-year bond's above 3.5, because that's when you really kick every part of the spectrum into rolling over at higher rates. And we've had this discussion before. We call that the debt black hole. In my mind, when the 30-year bond yield crosses, and frankly, the 2 years already there, you know, you could say the U.S. bond market is already in the black hole. And the amount of energy that the Fed's going to have to expend to bring it out of a black hole, well, you know, light doesn't escape a black hole. There's not enough energy in the universe to do it. Okay, this is where it comes back to the Fed. What does the Fed do? Do they push too far? Where now your interest cost is out of control at the same time that the consumer is dead. And now your revenues are going down because tax collections are down and so on and so on and so on. I mean, you see how everything's so intertwined right now and how everything is so tenuous. Gosh, I'm old enough to know I love to play basketball. When I'm, you know, mid-50s, a couple of years ago, I played and snapped my Achilles. All right. I'm not going to play basketball again. You know, it's one of those things that's like, it's so tenuous. Something's going to snap. It's inevitable. You know, it's an 80-year-old guy we're talking about trying to play basketball with a bunch of 20-year-olds. It's not going to end well.
Let me put something out there. We're running or approaching $1 trillion deficits. We just got a tax stimulus of $1.5 trillion. Congress increased spending by $300 billion. If the Fed keeps raising interest rates to ward off inflation or is forced to do that, what happens, Greg, if they push rates too high, too far? We end up in a recession where, as you mentioned, tax revenues fall, government expenditures go through the roof. Now, what does the government do to bring us out of a recession. Last time, it took driving interest rates down to zero. It took expanding the Fed's balance sheet by over $4 trillion. It took raising government spending where we created trillion-dollar deficits. What do they do next time?
Well, I mean, that's a huge question. And I think that's one of the things that was bugging the Fed so much like a year ago. I mean, they were panicking to want to get some symmetry to their policy options because you're at zero, okay? You are now committed to shrinking the balance sheet. What do you do if something happens? So they were panicking. I mean, I think all of this going to neutrality is to create some policy options on the next downturn. So the question really, and let's backstep for 1 second, because in terms of recession, in terms of the Fed pushing too far, the Fed pushing too far is not an issue right now for the budget in terms of the debt and the deficit, but that's a huge long-term issue that will implode at some point in time. But there's a more immediate dynamic that would happen first, all right, that needs to be watched as the tell, so to speak, and that's simply the consumer, Jim. I mean, we've talked about this too. The amount of consumer credit that has been created in the last 34 months is unprecedented. It is mind-boggling. It is $200 billion a month on average for over 30 months, and many of those months was even higher consecutively when you're talking about a 12-month increase, by the way. You're at record levels, okay? So your interest cost there is already higher just because of the nominal amount of debt. Imagine interest rates go up. The consumer is the one that's on the hook, and the consumer has borrowed, has gone on a borrowing binge that's not that dissimilar, frankly, from 2006 and 2007, okay? The vehicle is different. The dynamic is the same, all right? In 2006 and 7, you had home prices. Basically, it was a paper asset, for all intents and purposes, going up in price. You borrowed against that paper profit that was never realized. And once the collateral value, the value of the house, the collateral upon which that money was borrowed went down, everyone's upside down. It's the same thing here. You can track the credit numbers to the stock market. And when you talk about household wealth, okay, New York Fed, household wealth dynamic, 47% of U.S. household wealth is now in the equity market. The only time it was ever high was the first quarter of 2000, right before the tech bubble imploded. All right. So it is very statistically, you can follow this. And in terms of go back to November, I mean, great retail sales. You had huge sales in Black Friday and Cyber Monday. I mean, just off the chart, good numbers. The consumer knew he was getting a tax cut. Okay. Do you think that credit's going to be paid down? No. Okay. He's going to use that tax cut to spend more because that's the only way they can kind of expand spending. And it's not about maintaining the numbers you spend. It's about growing them. Everything is predicated upon growth. So staying even isn't good enough in any respect because ultimately it'd be too much and it'll fall in on itself. So when you talk about the consumer who has borrowed against the stock market, you know, and credit card debt that week in November, that Thanksgiving week, the single largest ever growth in credit card debt in a single week in history. All right. It's on credit. It is borrowed against the paper profits in the stock market. If the stock market goes down, the consumer goes down hard, and that's your risk of a recession, not so much the government. Now, what does the Fed do? Well, the question becomes, and we see stagflation all over the world, and it's here. It's just not as evident quite yet in the final demand numbers, but it's starting to show up. If you look at the Redbook sales this past week, they were horrible. All right. Breaking down the whole trend since 2016, because this is all built on the best you got from Trump. Deregulation, tax cuts, capital repatriation, big spending package. What do you have left? Trade and immigration. Those aren't the big positives you need to drive this market to another $1 trillion in wealth creation, because it's about growth and you're not going to have it. Not to the degree the Fed thinks, that's for sure. So it ties back to, does the Fed push too hard where the consumer gets whacked? And that is a very difficult question. We're going to find out the answer, I think, because frankly, the Fed's going to be put to the test. Inflation is going to keep rising. And what are they going to do? Because you're not going to have the growth in the consumer that's going to support the Fed going where they think they may need have to go to maintain neutral relative to inflation. They're going to have a choice to make here. And it's going to be really interesting to see what they do.
Well, it's a rather interesting dynamic. As you pointed out, record consumer credit card debt fueling much of the Christmas season last year. In this year, the consumer got a break. They got a tax cut coming from the government. But as you and I have been talking about, against those tax cuts, they're also paying higher prices at the grocery store and at the gas pump. So on one hand, they're getting more money. On the other hand, they're paying more for the stuff they need on a daily basis.
Yeah. And you see that in the sense that normally, okay, there's a direct inverse correlation between gasoline sales, retail sales. Of course, that's mostly linked to prices, changes in gasoline, like food. You know, you're not going to have all of a sudden people are driving 50% more. It's not how it works. All right. Well, right now, sales at gasoline stations is by far the biggest growth. It's 17.7% year over year. Okay. But because of the tax cut, all right, it is not having as big a negative impact as it would have last year, the year before. And we track these numbers dollar for dollar. Something I do is break down the actual dollars spent every single month. And you could see it for, you know, 2015, 2016, particularly, you know, as gasoline prices came down, the consumers spend more at eating and drinking establishments. As gasoline prices go up, they spend less at eating and drinking establishments. It is the margin of discretionary spending is going out to eat and drink, straight up, very simple. And right now, you had a big decline, okay, because gasoline prices are up. And remember the hurricane last fall and, you know, the disruptions in Houston and so on and so forth, right? You got down to a subpar and subinflation level of growth in eating and drinking establishments, but they're back up. They're not big, but they're 5%, which for them is, you know, kind of break even almost. All right. But it has supported retail sales where the stagflation is a little less here because of it. No doubt about it. It's had a positive impact. But, you know, like you say, the fact that gas and food have eaten away at a lot of that and it's not necessarily seen. So, yeah, it would be stronger without it. And that's, to me, you want to get back to the Fed dot plot and the whole nine yards real quick, because this is a really interesting point. When you look at their nominal growth rate estimate for this year, nominal, it's 4.5 for the year. I don't even understand where they get that number. I know the Atlanta Fed's at 4 and a lot of private guys are at 4. Where is 4% going to come from, let alone 4.5? I sure don't see it. It's not in the numbers I'm looking at. I'll tell you that much, not in terms of final demand.
Yeah, and especially if the consumer accounts for nearly 70% of the economy. Let's talk about what does the Fed do, and could they end up doing what the Fed did in the 70s? You've got a consumer that's tapped out, record debt levels. The only good thing is stocks are up, real estate is up. So maybe the consumer feels a little better about the debt they've taken on. But we all know that the debt you take on remains when asset values can decline, as we saw in the last downturn, when stocks lost 58% in the S&P and real estate fell 40%. The debt levels don't fall. They remain. So what does the Fed do? If you get to a situation where the economy starts to weaken, the consumer feels pinched because of rising inflation on day-to-day goods, do they stop? Do they fall behind the curve? And let's also talk about the meaning behind this in terms of the long-term trend in interest rates. You have a chart in your pack of the two-year note, which is broken out of a long-term downtrend.
Yeah, well, I mean, this, again, you know, it's the $64 million question, and it's the $128 million question, and, you know, it's the, you just keep extrapolating that higher and higher. I don't know what the Fed's going to do. I mean, this is the question because no one can tell. I can tell you what the Fed says they're going to do and what the market thinks they're going to do, and that's where the gap is that you try and navigate. So, I mean, the Fed has been very straightforward. They're going to chase inflation higher to at least 2.5% on Fed funds this year. I can tell you right now, the Fed funds futures doesn't price that. Doesn't price that at all. It prices 0% probability that's going to happen. I mean, so think about that. All right. And if you have bet on the dot plot or the market since the Fed went to tap out in 2014, you were best served betting on the market by far. Now, part of this is because the Fed uses the dot plot to initiate policy changes without having to do anything. Brilliantly, I might add. If you go back to 2014, taper went to tap out. What did they do? All right. They jacked the dot plot so steep, all right, that it caused this massive move in the futures markets to where the strip in Eurodollar deposit rates or in the Fed funds was so steep. In other words, you were expecting the Fed to be a 3.75% Fed funds by last year if you followed the dot plot in August of 2014. All right. So they initiated this massive tightening on the back of the end of QE that never actually happened, but totally happened in the forward markets. And that's what drove the dollar so much higher. Okay. You kind of had the flip flop here now. So that's why the dollar was hurting last year, because even as the Fed was starting to raise rates, you know, you knew they were not going to get as high as they had said they were going to get in the past. All right. So is that the case now? Is the case now where the Fed is still kind of talking tough on inflation because inflation is rising? And in reality, the second the consumer or the stock market wobbles to the point where it looks like they're going to fall down, you know, drunken falling down, our stag party dynamic, okay, then the Fed basically reverses course. Now, all of this is built up to give them some interest rate power. So then the question becomes, see, that by being tough now, they can talk the market down a little bit before they have to turn and actually cut rates. They don't want to have to do that. Now they absolutely want to avoid that at all costs because that makes them really look bad. So they talk tough so they can verbally be more dovish and execute kind of an ease from the slope of the futures market without having to actually do anything. I think that's how it plays out, all right, because they can't turn tail. We know they don't want to undo shrinkage. They've told us this. We don't want to use QE again in the next stage until we've already exhausted interest rates again. They've told us this. So we know. How do they proceed if they want to change course here? They can't just come out and cut rates. They can't do it. They're going to have to verbally shift first. And that's why I think they are still kind of standing tough here, because the longer they can wait, the more firepower it gives them down the road if the consumer gets whacked and the stock market's down 25%. And that's probably how it's going to have to play out. The question then is, how much pain in the market does it take to get the Fed to get there? I don't know. We're going to find out.
And that's a good transition point. I want to begin with a clip you and I were talking about this week from one of our favorite movies, Trading Places. Could we play the clip when they're heading to the pits to take on the Dukes?
Think big. Think positive. Never show any sign of weakness. Always go for the throat. Buy low, sell high. Fear, that's the other guy's problem. Nothing you have ever experienced can prepare you for the unbridled carnage you're about to witness. The Super Bowl, the World Series, they don't know what pressure is. In this building, it's either kill or be killed. You make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners. 1 minute, you're up $500,000 in soybeans, and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
Yeah, but we gotta kill them!
I love that movie. It's one of my favorite lines. And, you know, we can maybe transpose that to today. One day you're up $500,000,000 in Facebook and boom, the next day your kids don't go to charter kindergarten. Let's talk about the implications for the stock market. And I want to talk about, it is almost mindless investing. And you and I have talked about this in the past. Indexing is the new fad. In my opinion, it's the new bubble. You've got hundreds of billions of dollars that are going into stock index funds, bond index funds, where, Greg, there is no analysis. There is no fund manager. And I discovered this last spring of last year when I was looking at who was buying Amazon or Netflix at 200 times earnings. If you're an S&P fund manager, and you get $100 million, you're not asking questions, should I buy Amazon at this level? Should I buy Netflix at this level? You just simply buy. No questions asked. You're not looking at Fed policy. You're not looking at risk. You're not looking at inflation. It is just mindless investing. So let's talk about all of this, whether it's stagflation overseas, growing stagflation here, possible trade wars escalating and getting out of control, rising interest rates, but more importantly, rising inflation. Let's talk about the stock market next.
Well, it's at risk. I mean, this is a bad scenario for stocks. Not only, you know, I mean, it's inflation's rising, but, you know, it's rising more on the input side. I mean, the Richmond Fed survey yesterday was glaring evidence of this. I mean, yes, prices paid made a new high, and yes, prices paid are now like 2%. I mean, excuse me, prices received. But prices paid just exploded, and it's 3.5%. So the margin here is so wide now that even if you can pass along some of the price increase, you're still getting hit on the margins. So it's not a good scenario for stocks. As I said before, stocks have been driven by just the Trump rally. You can't really call it anything else. I mean, the market rallied from the day he got elected. The day he got elected, that night, we put out a piece to buy industrials and regional banks. And that was the right play then. And to the degree that things have, you know, wobbled and wafted since then. All right. I think one of the most glaring things out there right now is the fact that the banks are no longer leading. The banks are not making new highs. And relative to the S&P, the banks are breaking down. What does that tell you? I mean, you know, we had the regional banks first. Then in September, when Yellen came out and gave us a more realistic dot plot, basically told us what they were going to do. Finally, neutralize, which made 2%. their goal for Fed funds. All right. We knew the 2-year note, which was 140, was going to respond. I mean, of course, it was mispriced. All right. So all the curve flattening that went into the first part of this had nothing to do with expectations of a downturn in the economy. They had to do with an adjustment to where inflation was, where neutral was, where the Fed was going to go in the 2-year note, which was mispriced. All right. So from that perspective, this was the swap into the big cap banks, Bank of America, you know, the big leaders. All right. They're breaking down, straight up breaking down, violating, you know, the big trend lines, particularly, you know, Morgan Stanley. I mean, it's violating its 10-year trend line here. So when you see that, it ties in with the whole thought process around the Fed's not going to be able to get rates to 2.5, you know, let alone 3. And that kind of all coincides. And when you start losing the leadership, and when you lose the leadership at a time that you have lost the policies that got you here, I mean, again, deregulation, okay, was big first. Then you had the tax cuts. You had the spending package. You had the repatriation of capital. It boosted capital spending. It boosted buybacks, of course, unintended consequence. All that has happened already. And outside of the benefit of the, you know, improved cash flow going forward from tax cuts, there's no new policies in line here, you know, to drive this market up another 20%. All right. That leaves the risk. And there's a risk we haven't talked about that might be the biggest risk out there right now. Okay. No, it's not Italy. Although that may be the second biggest risk. Okay. Stagflation, maybe second, Italy third, but Italy's part of stagflation. What I'm talking about, Jim, is immigration. I'm not talking about the wall. I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Europe. I'm talking about the German political setup. I'm talking about the elections in Spain and the elections in Italy, where peripheral parties gained positions of strength enough so to be ruling Italy. Okay. This has caused a divide in Europe, with France, Germany, Netherlands on one side, Spain, Portugal, Greece, and Italy on the other side. All right. We saw it was a summit this weekend, or I think it even got postponed or lasted through to today. At the end of the day, Merkel is losing her huge support with her coalition partner and in her own party. In the meantime, the peripheral parties are picking up strength, and you have big elections in September where Merkel's going to lose the Bundestag and the Bundesrat, okay, and could potentially completely lose her grip and power. You could see a complete disintegration in Europe on the back of immigration, not debt, not Italy, although these things would be an offshoot of that. I mean, you talk about, you saw the movie the day after or the morning after, whatever it was, with the global storm, right? I mean, it could kind of be this situation. You have this global storm already over Canada, tracking to the U.S. You have this global storm kind of in Europe that's getting worse. You know, I mean, if you get much more in terms of trade, you're going to have a global storm in Asia as it relates to, you know, what's going on in China. And of course, Japan, the Bank of Japan just came out today and said, hey, you know, we can do more with monetary policy. Guess what? No, you can't. All right. Your line of the balance sheet expansion is almost straight up and down. It doesn't get any more steep. It can't go any more parabolic. So yeah, you got a lot of problems. And if you think you're going to see another 25% in the stock market, I think that that is extremely foolhardy thought process. That's not to say if you got a resolution of the trade situation, you might see a one-off pop rally here that maybe even takes you to new highs. I don't know. All right. But you're living on borrowed time here, because bottom line is the risk is now outweighing the rewards. It's that simple.
Well, I mean, if you're just looking at this market in terms of valuations, 200 times earnings, if you're looking at even the S&P, let's talk about some of the charts. You're seeing a breakdown of the blue chip averages. The Dow below its 200-day moving average, the transports below its 200-day moving average, the utilities below its 200-day average. Is that sort of a harbinger of things to come?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you're right. I'll tell you what, the S&P where it is today is basically flirting with its real big kind of first breakdown pivot. Because if you get below this pivot, you talk about the 200-day, those things are below the 200-day. The S&P is at the 100-day. The NASDAQ, the upside leader, is at the 50-day. So they're all kind of on a relative basis at key technical levels. All right. One thing I watch is the PNQI. It's an ETF of the tech retailers. All right. This is really a benchmark thing for the stock market to keep an eye on. It has all the big, you know, ridiculously priced. Let's not even talk about, you know, how do you sell block shares of a $1,500 per share stock into a market that has no volume? I mean, that's the, you know, you want to talk about the index funds. You know, the question is, do index funds sell? And not to go backwards, but it's important to point to make in the context of what we're talking about. You know, I mean, do the index funds sell? Where is the uncle point? Because the reason I gave you that line from Trading Places, okay, and the reason I use the line, you know, now you're up a half a billion in Facebook because you got to use inflation for this, right? The reason we did that in our special report is very simple, because this is the level of complacency. It's like one minute you're up a half a million in soybeans, the next minute your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. I love that line. I use that line all the time. I have that whole speech memorized, and it's never been more pertinent than it is right now, because that is how quickly you could lose a half a million dollars and lose your Bentley and so on and so on and so forth. I mean, it really is. So I think the level of complacency is way overdone, and that gets to the index funds, and it gets to the hardcore people that, you know, would be the last to liquidate. You know, what is the liquidation dynamic? How does that play out? I mean, because if you kind of get what we think is going to happen, they're still going to be long, and they have been conditioned over years to stay long. And maybe the Fed comes out of the woodwork and saves them again. I don't know, but we're going to find out. And that's the whole point, is we're going to find out. And when you talk about, you know, what does the Fed do? I mean, the Fed tries to save the market here and it doesn't work. That's your worst case scenario. That's where that guy who's holding index funds, you know, with faith, with total faith, all right, that the Fed is God Almighty and is going to save the day again. That's when you have your bigger picture problem. You know, it really is. But in terms of technicals, you are right there. And not only that, you know, Jim, but I mean, when you look at the S&P or any of these indexes, you know, you had your little, you know, correction in February. You didn't do any damage to this market in terms of technicals. This thing is still as technically stretched as it's ever been, ever, and is widely owned. And that's just a bad combination.
You know, something else I want to throw in here that really struck me is you've got three institutions, Greg, that control almost 88% of the S&P through their index funds. You take a stock like Amazon at 1700. When these funds, or when investors panic or move in the hurt, we don't know how big that will be at this point. Who do these guys, if there's three guys in the room that basically own the market, who is going to be on the other side of that bet to buy a $1,700 stock when these guys have to sell? You know, I don't know too many individual clients that have enough bucks that could buy, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of shares of Amazon at $1,700 a share.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been saying that for better part of 6 months. I mean, really have that exact point. You and I have talked about this specifically. I mean, when you look at the volume numbers, the trend line that captures either weekly or monthly volume is straight down, because as these things get higher in price, there's less volume. Of course, you know, that does nothing to talk about the value of the stock trade is still high. I mean, let's understand exactly what we're trying to communicate here. All right. But the fact of the matter is that the people who own these number of shares are going to want to sell that number of shares. They're not going to look at it at what value of my stock am I selling. They're going to look at how many shares do I have? How many shares do I want to sell? And like you say, and like I've said for 6 months, the issue here is you are facing a vacuum of buyers, a vacuum, a complete potential meltdown. Now, the question becomes, if there is that level of tightness in the people that kind of control the market, if you will, I mean, they just say, we're never going to sell. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's still the people that matter are the people directing those people. So, you know, it gets back to the question I said before, kind of the bigger picture question as to how much pain actually has to be inflicted before the Fed kind of reverses course depends on those people that are embedded in the market now in the passive funds that have been conditioned and told over and over again to where they buy this as faith that they should not sell on a decline. We'll see if that's tested or not. And then, you know, what's the outcome? Because, you know, if you sell off here, okay, you need to bring the market back up here, or all you have is the credit that people are going to have to pay off without feeling as comfortable about their nest egg. I mean, so it's not just, will the market sell off here? It's kind of, well, then what happens there? And that's the $64 million question with the Fed. That leads you to the next bigger picture question. You know, can you actually think the Fed is going to be able to bring the kind of firepower they're going to need to bring, which is going to be substantial in terms of dollars, to get this market back to a new high? If you lose 30%, I don't know that they can do it. Not by just saying, okay, we won't raise rates again. That's not going to be good enough.
And could we see a situation as we did in the crisis of 2008? And you remember this, Greg, every single Monday, Hank Paulson would have a press conference and they would announce some new alphabet soup program to bring the market out. And I mean, the Fed earnestly was working with the Treasury, and it took them 6 months until they got rid of mark-to-market accounting in March. and the Fed announced a $1.2 trillion quantitative easing program. The Obama administration announced a $1 trillion spending program. I mean, it literally took $2 trillion to finally wake up the market. Hey, they're going to actually turn this thing around. I just don't think a few comments, hey, we're going to stop and pause for a minute, is really going to do much if all of a sudden panic and all of the things we've been talking about start to set in.
No, I mean, it would almost be like a sneak attack. I mean, it's almost like it would be a kind of a Pearl Harbor situation. I think you'd be stunned and then you wouldn't know what to do. You don't have the same kind of cohesive cooperation either in Washington. You know, let's talk about that. If you want to talk about a crisis hitting, you can't think of a worse time politically in this country to have to deal with a crisis. Holy mackerel, you'd love to think that in a crisis, people will put aside their personal differences. But in this case, that's questionable. So that's a whole nother argument, as you're speaking to. And, you know, this is my point. It really is. I mean, this is why I said this before. The Fed can't just turn around and cut rates. You know, they're not going to be able to do that. So this makes it very difficult and tricky to see how they're going to play out. Now, having said that, Jim, you know, and I know, and this is the book I wrote way back in 2006, when we said all of 2007 and 8 was going to happen. All right. What did we say would happen after that? The Fed would do whatever it took to not fall into a debt deflation when pushed to that precipice and looking into that ravine that represents a debt deflation. The Fed will do whatever they have to do. So if that comment still stands, and I think as a philosophy, it kind of has to, because it is the truth, I think, still. All right. They're going to have a much harder job doing it here. No doubt about it. No doubt about it. Let alone that as every other component of this goes up in terms of the actual value of dollars that we're talking about, that means the application of the Band-Aid would have to be that much bigger. So, yeah, that's why I say if we're in a black hole here in terms of the economy, and it's one of these things we just don't know it yet. All right. I don't know if the Fed has the energy to do something that in physics is allegedly impossible. And that's to, you know, get light out of a black hole.
Let's talk about something that does not look right, given the circumstances that you and I have been discussing here. Let's talk about gold, because if we do get to a situation, and I agree with you, Greg, I just don't think saying, hey, we're going to go on pause or a few rate cuts is going to do it. They'll have to resort to anything possible to turn this thing around. What are the implications for gold here? Because gold has been in a downtrend. Given this scenario with stagflation, there's something wrong with this picture.
Yeah, and that's the title of our piece on gold. There is something wrong with this picture. We have a strategy to deal with gold. And at the end of the day, gold be higher. It's really almost that simple. Does that mean there's not potential pain in the interim? I think gold does have some additional downside, only because I think the dollar has some additional upside. But I think there are factors at work already specific that will change this and will change it quickly. I think it's the kind of thing you're not going to see it coming when it changes. And I think the gold market is one that's going to be kind of, you know, you're getting people actually getting short here. You kind of lull them into thinking, you know, gold is a loser again. And I think it's going to be one of these quick turnarounds where you better be ready, because it's going to happen fast. We like gold longer term a lot.
Well, let's talk about this piece as we close here. A lot of our listeners may not know that you deal with a lot of hedge funds that pay five figures to get your research. You're one of the few people I know when you do a deep dive, and I'm talking, folks, he gets into the weeds like nobody else I know in the business. I asked you to put together a special report. You were kind enough. I see a lot of your big macro stuff, and there were so many cross currents going around. I asked, let's put this together in one piece. And would you do me a favor and make this available to listeners at a reasonable price? Let's talk about seeking shelter from the storm.
Yeah, well, you know, like you said, wanted to do something special for your customers, and that's just great. You do such a great job. So we're happy to participate in that and give them a kind of a taste of what really, you know me, Jim, I'm a really humble guy. And, you know, I feel very grateful and just lucky in my life to be in a position where I can do what I love to do every day and actually get paid for it. It's almost not even about the money. It's about a lifestyle. And I feel like I'm on a working vacation in perpetuity. But yes, we have the largest, most successful hedge funds in the world are my customers. They want to know what I think. And that just blows my mind. But, you know, so be it. And we wanted to give a taste of that to your customers at a price that is not a hedge fund related price, for sure. Something that's, you know, ridiculously cheap relative to the waters that we swim in. And I think we've basically just decided to give you guys everything. I mean, everything I'm thinking right here, right now. It's a massive piece. We put it together. It covers all the macro themes that we're looking at right now. And it includes strategies specific going forward, specific markets, specific strategies, long and short, that we think will help you weather this storm that we feel is coming and is inevitable. And it is going to be fierce. And it's kind of like, I think I like the way I might even have to, you know, as I go on with this theme in the next coming weeks and so on and so forth with my customers, you know, I love the kind of the day after tomorrow theme, because you do, you kind of got three geostorms going on here. And I really think that that is a good analogy. And you're going to want to be traveling south, you know, to avoid, you know, it's one of those things you remember in the movie where all of a sudden this whole Mexico-U.S. border thing, it's kind of one of those things in a crisis where we all become one race, i.e. the human race, the way it should be everywhere at all times, you know. So it's kind of interesting. But I think in terms of protecting your customers, because that's what it's about. You always want to be expanding your money. It's protection and expand instead of expand and protect. And I think that we're kind of in the latter stage. So we want to shelter from the storm ideas first. There's a storm coming. So understand you need at least an umbrella. And then number two is, that's not to say you can't make some money here. So maybe here's some ideas that will help you do that.
Yeah, the name of the report is Seeking Shelter from the Storm, and it features a number of things I think you're going to find incredibly valuable. The Global Stag Party, the Global Stag Party Part 2, with especially Germany and Canada, the Global Stag Party Part 3, the black budget hole that we were discussing here, and then the Fed's folly, getting back, and what happens to the stock market, and what's wrong with the pitcher of gold. And Greg, you've made this at a special price for our listeners. Can you tell us how our listeners can find out more about this package and how they could get it?
Sure. I think you're making it available on one of your websites, or they can email us directly. And that would be an email to Caitlin Ellis. And that's Caitlin Ellis@gmail.com. You can always email me through the website or gregweldon@weldononline.com. But yeah, I think we have it set up so they can go in and use their card or whatever to pay and get the report like right there instead of having to get to us. We bill you, we send it. That takes more time. So we have it set up with your guys on the backside who've been just very helpful and always are, to point and click buy somewhere on one of your websites.
It's amazing. We're both thinking the same thing. Your piece is Seeking Shelter from the Storm, and mine's going to be The Perfect Financial Storm. So heads up, folks, a lot of stuff that is coming. And I use this analogy, Greg. You're in Florida. So you're on the beach in Florida. You're looking out. It's a warm, sunny, balmy day. You know, there's no wind. The waves are calm. It's looking beautiful. But what you're not seeing on that shore is a tropical front that's developing off the west coast of Africa that's heading your way. And that's when you need to take shelter from the storm. And that's the name of the piece. Greg, I want to thank you for putting this together and joining me in an extensive interview, because there was just too much stuff here that I didn't want to cover in a 15, 20-minute segment. And I'm glad you were generous of your time today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I really feel like we need to do a service to people out there who, you know, need to understand what's going on and maybe don't always get exactly, you know, the pinpoint truth that they need to make smart decisions. And in many decisions, I'm a big time poker player. You know that. Big stakes, playing the World Series of Poker on the World Poker Tour. And I can say this, sometimes folding is the strongest move.
Couldn't agree more. Well, listen, Greg, have a happy 4th of July weekend, and thanks for coming on the program.
My pleasure, Jim. Take care.
You know, in listening to this interview, Jim, there's a real contrast between what you and Greg Weldon were discussing versus what the markets are preoccupied with and or the general financial media, because these are storms that are forming very rapidly. It does remind you of and I like this because you go down and sit on the beach in Florida and it can be a sunny day and everybody's having a great time. And just over the horizon where you can't see it, these gigantic hurricane clouds are forming. And you know that although it looks just great right now, it's going to be miserable within hours, you know, and that's the same analogy right now. The markets aren't talking about all this stuff, but of course, that's what you've been doing well here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And speaking of what you do, what are you going to be doing in future weeks?
We're going to be entering Q2 earnings season. And as Greg and I were talking about, we're seeing the best that the markets have had to offer. The tax cuts, the government stimulus, all of that's happening. And as Greg and I were talking about, the Fed may be using tough language, but the futures market is already starting to discount that fourth rate hike, that things may begin to weaken as we see troubles overseas, especially as Ned Schmidt and I talked about when it comes to negotiating with these tariffs. Let's put it this way. We own the best looking shirt in a dirty laundry basket right now. So all of those things we'll be looking at in the future. But right now, second quarter earnings season will be upon us next month. And then, of course, in the month of August, we'll have the Jackson Hole Conclave when Fed officials get together and they tell us, oh, yes, all those oracles, what they plan to do in the fall. This is going to be an interesting year, John. We've got all the stimulus against Fed monetary policy, and this is also an election year. So will the houses of Congress change leadership? In other words, will the Democrats retake Congress? So a lot of volatility as we head into the fall, tariff wars, all kinds of things. There's going to be plenty to worry about. But maybe that will create plenty of opportunities. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.